When they approached the depot, they saw an open coffin standing up against one of the support posts on the roofed depot platform. Inside the coffin was the body of the third train robber. The undertaker had cleaned up his head wound and crossed his arms across his chest. He was holding a pistol in his right hand. His eyes were open and glazed. On the top of the coffin was a sign that read,
"Does anyone know this man?"
At the bottom of the coffin was another sign.
"Warning to train robbers. This could be you."
Sheriff Jacobs walked with Smoke to the train, then shook his hand just before he boarded.
"Come back any time, Mr. Johnson. You will always be welcome."
"Thanks."
As Emmett Clark drew closer to Desolation, he passed through a canyon on the left side of which rose a high bluff. After passing the bluff, he looked back, and about halfway up the side of the canyon wall, a column could be seen jutting out in front of the bluff, crowned with what looked like the feathers of a war bonnet. This gave the canyon its name, War Bonnet. Clark was coming to Desolation because he had overheard some saloon conversation back in Geneva that Desolation was not a place anyone would want to visit because of its lack of law. Clark wasn't the law, per se, but his occupation of hunting down wanted men and turning them in for the reward wouldn't likely be one that would be welcomed either. He decided, therefore, to pass himself off as someone who was on the dodge from the law. Desolation was laid out along one long street. In the middle of the street, on the west side, was a railroad depot, complete with a small white sign with the name of the town and the altitude neatly painted in black letters. Desolation. Elevation, 4,135 feet. Clark found the presence of a railroad depot to be rather unusual, since there was obviously no railroad. Railroad Avenue continued on as a wagon trail running north and south of the town. He saw at least 24 people in town, mostly in little clusters of 2 or 3 men. He saw no women and no children, which he took as a good indication that this was the kind of town that had been described to him, an outlaw town. At intervals all up and down Railroad Avenue, there were boards stretched across the dirt streets to allow people to cross when the roads were full of mud. There were obviously no street cleaners, nor any kind of city sanitation workers. For unlike those towns where the horse droppings were picked up on a regular basis, this street was covered with manure, and the stench was almost unbearable. Clark stopped in front of a saloon. In keeping with the theme of the town, it was called the Railroad Saloon. Dismounting, he tied off his horse, then went inside. There were several people inside the saloon, and here, for the first time, Clark saw women. They were all wearing brightly colored ruffled skirts that came no lower than their knees. Under the bell-shaped skirts could be seen colorfully laced petticoats that barely reached their kid boots, which were adorned with tassels. Their arms and shoulders were bare, their bodices cut low over their bosoms, and their dresses decorated with sequins and fringe. One of them, seeing Clark come in, smiled and came toward him.
"My, what a handsome young man you are. You don't look anything at all like an outlaw."
"Outlaw?"
"Honey, you are an outlaw, aren't you? Because if you aren't, I would advise you to just keep on going."
"How'd you know I was an outlaw? Does it show on my face?"
"Oh, honey, didn't you know everybody in Desolation is an outlaw?"
"Nah, I didn't know."
"Hey, you, Cindy, get the hell away from him. You're my woman."
"I ain't nobody's woman, Jules Stillwater."
"You're my woman till I tell you you ain't my woman no more. Now get me my friend's drink."
There were two other men sitting at the table with the one Cindy had called Stillwater. One of the men sitting with him was a fairly large man with broad shoulders, but what stood out most about him was the disfiguring scar on his face. Half of one eyelid was missing, and part of his lip was cut away so that he couldn't completely close his mouth. This fit exactly the description Clark had heard of Frank Dodd.
Is that Frank Dodd?
Yes. Why do you ask?
I'd like to meet him.
Honey, believe me, you don't want anything to do with him. If you think Stillwater is trouble, you ain't seen nothing till you cross Frank Dodd.
Well, I'll just have to see to it that I don't cross him, won't I?
It was mid-afternoon by the time the train reached Cloverdale. Cloverdale was at the end of the line for the Nevada Central Railroad, and at the far end of the depot, there was a roundhouse that would be used to turn the engine around for its return trip. Smoke Jensen stepped down from the train. Then he walked up to the attached stock car as his saddle and rifle were offloaded and his horse led down the car ramp. The station master came up to him.
Is this your horse, mister?
Yes, I'm Kirby Jensen.
You gonna take him now, or do you want to put him up?
I'd like to put him up for a while, if you can recommend a place.
Yes, sir, I certainly can recommend a place. We have a livery here at the depot, if you'd like to leave him here.
My saddle and my rifle?
We can take care of those, too.
Good.
Smoke took out $2 and gave it to the station master.
I'll be back before this runs out.
Well, there he goes, Sheriff!
Smoke instinctively drew his pistol, then moved quickly to the rear of the train to see what was going on. A figure suddenly appeared on the railroad track, having run up the slight grade on the other side. He was a small man dressed as a cowboy and with a bushy walrus-type mustache. The young cowboy looked back into the direction from which he had come, and Smoke saw terror in his eyes. The cowboy fell, sliding on his back head first down the railroad embankment on the near side. Smoke ran over to him and saw bubbles of blood coming from his mouth. Smoke looked up to see two men, both wearing badges, standing on the tracks at the top of the embankment. One of the men was holding a smoking gun in his hand. Putting the pistol in his holster, he came down from the tracks to look at the man he had just shot.
What about it, Sheriff Wallace? Is he dead?
Oh, yeah. He's dead. Who are you?
I just got off the train.
I didn't ask how you got here. I asked who you were, and I expect an answer.
My name is Kirby.
Did you know him? Reason I ask, I'm not gonna have to deal with you trying to get revenge for him or anything, am I?
I've never seen the man before.
Well, you're lucky. His name is Andy Emerson. He rides, that is, he rode, for Milk Point, Dexter. Son of a bitch has been nothing but trouble for the last year. I've had him in jail more often than not.
Why'd you shoot him?
Because he ran when I ordered him to stop.
He isn't armed.
He ran.
What difference does that make if he ran? It's not like he was going to get away from you, is it? You know his name, you know where he works.
Mister, you are that close to interfering with the law.
By now, the crowd began to gather around Emerson's body, as many of the people who had been at the depot were drawn by the scene of the excitement. Smoke, not wanting to be a part of a circus, drifted away. As he walked back to the depot, he saw a paperboy standing at the edge of the platform selling newspapers.
Get your news leaf here! Paper! Paper! Cloverdale news leaf here!
The boy looked up at Smoke.
Is Mr. Emerson dead?
Yes.
I'd better get back to the newspaper office and tell Mr. Cutler. He'll be a-wanting to write a story about it, I reckon. You just get into town?
Yes.
Then I'll expect you'll be wanting a copy of the news leaf. It'll give you all the news of the town, and it'll also tell you all about the hanging.
The hanging?
Yes, sir. Come Friday, there's going to be a hanging right here in town. Why, if you was to walk down the street a bit, you'll see the gallows. It's going to be something to see, I'll bet.
Are you
going to
watch it?
No, sir. I reckon Mr. Cabot done what they said he done. I mean, he was caught red-handed by them folks that was on the train and all. But he was always just real nice to me. Bought a paper for me every week. And once he gave me a quarter tip for no reason at all. I think watching a hanging might be exciting and all that. But I ain't in no particular mind to see Mr. Cabot hang.
I'll take a paper.
Yes, sir. That'll be 5 cents.
5 cents? Most papers cost only 2 cents.
Yes, sir. Folks keep telling Mr. Cutler that, but he says that as long as he's the only newspaper in town, he figures he can charge whatever folks will pay for it.
I guess he has a point.
The boy handed him the paper, which consisted of a single sheet that was printed on both sides. As promised, the lead story concerned Bobby Lee Cabot.
Hanging on Friday. At 10 o'clock of the morning on Friday the 31st instant, Sheriff Herman Wallace, duly armed with a death warrant signed by His Honor Judge Jeremiah Briggs, will escort Bobby Lee Cabot to the gallows, there to affix a rope around his neck for the purpose of dispatching his soul to eternity. Cabot is paying the ultimate penalty of death by hanging for his part in the robbery of the Nevada Central train on the night of the 21st ultimate. The robbers, believed to be the Frank Dodd gang, relieved the Nevada Central messenger of $5,120, said money being transferred from the Bank of Reno to the Bank of Cloverdale. Although the messenger, August Fletcher, cooperated in every way, he was shot down in cold blood by the robbers. Mr. Fletcher was married and the father of four. He was a deacon in his church, and it is said of him that no finer man ever walked the streets of Cloverdale. A trial, fairly conducted and with the verdict delivered by the unanimous vote of 12 men, good and true, has determined that the life of this wonderful man was cut short by the evil doings of Cabot. The execution of Bobby Lee Cabot is to be publicly conducted, with no restrictions applied as to who may attend. All who love justice are invited to be present at the hour appointed. A great crowd present to witness Cabot being delivered into the hands of Satan will send a signal to all who would contemplate duplicating Cabot's foul deed.
After reading the story, Smoke perused the advertisements, finding one for a hotel.
Depot Hotel, Fremont Street, Cloverdale, Nevada. William R. Chamberlain, proprietor. This hotel is situated by the railroad track and is but a step from our establishment to the cars of Nevada Central on one side and the Nevada Overland Stagecoach Depot on the other. All the appointments of a first-class hotel are herein supplied. Connected to this hotel is a first-class restaurant where one might find pig's feet, ham, and other delicacies.
Folding the paper up and sticking it in his pocket, Smoke left the depot, stepping out onto Fremont Street. Seeing the gallows at the far end of the street, Smoke decided to walk down for a closer inspection.
You here for the hanging?
Looking toward the sound of the voice, Smoke saw an old white-haired man sitting on a chair that was tipped back against the front of the post office.
Maybe.
It's going to be quite a show. It's a shame they're hanging the wrong fella, though.
Why do you say that?
Hell, it was Frank Dodd that done the actual shooting. They was two or three folks on the train that night that seen everything. This here fella there about to hang wasn't doing nothing but sort of standing back. But the judge said that don't matter. He was there, so that makes him as guilty as Dodd.
Do you know the man that they're going to hang?
I've seen him around here a few times. Always seemed like a decent sort to me. Don't seem like he would be the kind to get himself mixed up with someone like Dodd. Of course, you could never tell about some folks. What you see in him ain't always what they really are.
Yeah, I have to agree with you.
He tried to say in his trial that he wasn't really riding with Dodd, that he was hooked up with him only so he could set a trap for him for the law.
Do you believe that?
Don't reckon it makes no never mind what I believe. I wasn't on the jury, and the jury didn't believe none of it.
I'd be interested in whether or not you believe him.
Why? What difference does it make to you?
Well, no difference. I was just curious, is all.
Well, I know what it's like to be curious, so I'll tell you. I believe him.
Why?
If for no other reason, it's because I don't believe the sheriff. If you ask me, the sheriff is about as crooked as they come. And seeing as Cabot said he was supposed to be working with the sheriff, and the sheriff is saying something directly opposite, why, in my book, there ain't no question as to which one of them I believe.
As Smoke continued down toward the gallows, he thought of the old man's condemnation of the sheriff. That mirrored the doubt that Sheriff Jacobs had expressed about Sheriff Wallace. And of course, Smoke's own interaction with Wallace tended to support that idea. From what Smoke could determine about the killing of the young cowboy, it would seem that the sheriff had little justification to shoot. When Smoke reached the gallows, he saw several people standing around, their attention drawn not only to the gallows, but to a huge, crudely painted sign. The sign hadn't been nailed to the gallows, but was on the ground, leaning up against the platform.
Come one, come all. Watch Bobby Lee fall. On Friday, the hanging will be. We welcome all to come and see.
The reaction to the sign was mixed. There were a few standing around who thought the doggerel funny, and they laughed about it and pointed it out to others. But there were just as many who thought that writing such bad poetry about someone being hanged was insensitive. Smoke looked over toward the jail and considered going inside to see Bobby Lee, but he decided not to do so yet. He had to figure out some way to help him, so that when he did see him, he would have a plan in place. Earlier, Bobby Lee had been napping on the cot in his jail cell when he heard the shooting, and he sat up, wondering what the shooting was about. Shortly after the shooting, he could hear some commotion out on the street, and though the conversation seemed to be intense, he wasn't able to hear clearly enough to make out what was happening.
Deputy? Deputy Beard, you out there?
Finally, after several calls, Beard came into the back of the jail.
What do you want?
What was the shooting?
You ain't heard?
I heard gunshots. I don't know what it was all about.
Sheriff Wallace just killed your friend.
My friend? Which friend?
Like somebody like you has got so many friends, you don't know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Andy Emerson. That's who I'm talking about.
What? Wallace killed him? Why? What did Andy do?
You might know that the sheriff told him not to come into the gold strike and get drunk no more. So what Emerson does is he went into Chinatown and was playing that gambling game them Chinamen like to play. The sheriff seen him in there, then told him he was arresting him for gambling at a place that didn't have no license. Only Emerson said he wasn't going to be arrested, and he started walking away. Now the sheriff yelled at him, give him a chance to stop, but he didn't. So the sheriff shot up into the air to warn him. So when he'd done that, Emerson commended to running, so the sheriff shot him. Hit him dead center.
That doesn't seem like much of a reason to be shooting anybody.
That's funny.
Funny? What the hell's so funny about it?
I mean, here you are about to hang, and you're worried about whether or not the sheriff had reason to shoot Andy Emerson. Most especially when you consider what kind of fella Emerson was.
Emerson was a good man at heart. I never was able to understand why the sheriff disliked him so. And it surprises me to hear that it went so far as the sheriff actually shooting him.
He was a damn drunk who didn't know his place. And the only thing that surprises me is the sheriff didn't shoot the son of a bitch any sooner.
Beard went back to the front of the building, closing the door behind him. Bobby Lee returned to his bunk, then lay back down. He thought about dying, and he wondered what was just on the other side. Would Emerson be there waiting for him? Would his ma? Would his sister? Bobby Lee had not been to church in a long time. He wished now that he had paid a little more attention when he had gone. Feeling much refreshed from a bath at the barber shop, Smoke went to the Depot Hotel.
Yes, sir. We have the finest rooms in the city. A gentleman of your stature will find nothing better.
I'd like a room overlooking the street.
Oh, I can do that. I do have a drummer who is regular and who will come in on tonight's train. He normally gets the room overlooking the street, but I'll be glad to let you have it.
I wouldn't want to put one of your regulars out.
Oh, don't worry about that, sir. As I said, he is nothing but a traveling salesman. I will accommodate a gentleman over a common drummer any day.
The hotel clerk was a small, unctuous man whose obsequiousness was beginning to get on Smoke's nerves in a hurry.
Will you be staying through Friday, sir?
I don't know yet.
Well, you should make it a point to stay through Friday.
Why? What is so important about Friday?
Oh, sir, did you not see the gallows down at the end of the street? We're going to have a hanging here on Friday. It's grisly business, to be sure, but it should be very exciting spectacle nevertheless, and something you'll be able to tell your grandchildren about.
Have you ever seen a hanging?
Oh, no, sir, I haven't. I've never been present when an execution was conducted.
Conducted?
Yeah, you know, as the legal extension of a court mandate.
I see. Well, I've seen hangings. And it isn't the kind of story you want to tell your grandchildren about.
Oh, yes, sir. I suppose it could be gruesome, all right. But the man being hanged is a killer, after all. And it isn't as if they're just lynching him. He was given a fair trial and found guilty by a jury of his peers. We had a judge and lawyers and everything. Besides, the man he killed was a husband and a father.
I heard the man who actually did the killing was Frank Dodd.
So they say. But Bobby Lee Cabot was present during the train robbery, and according to the law, that makes him as guilty as if he had actually pulled the trigger.
You've read for the law, have you?
No, sir. But I have followed this case with some degree of interest, and I know that the judge instructed the jury to base their decision not as to whether Cabot actually did the killing, but on the fact that he was there at the time of the killing. Oh, that makes him complicit in the murder.
I'm sure.
Smoke gave the clerk a dollar.
This will cover my stay for tonight. If I decide to stay longer, I'll give you more money.
Very good, sir.
Reaching up beside him, he pulled down a key and gave it to Smoke.
Your room is 201. It is at the top of the stairs, the first door on the left. I'm sure you'll find it quite satisfactory, but should you have any problems, please don't hesitate to let me know.
Nodding, Smoke picked up his saddlebags and, throwing them over his shoulder, climbed the steps. The room was typical of many hotel rooms that Smoke had occupied in his life. The bed was high with a curving iron head and footboards. Sitting beside the bed was a table with a kerosene lamp. On the wall at the foot of the bed was a brown chiffer robe, upon which sat an empty basin and pitcher of water. There was no carpeting on the wide plank floor, and the boards, which had once been painted a deep brown, were now faded in spots. The wallpaper was cream-colored and emblazoned with baskets of purple irises. Smoke walked over to the window and raised the green shade so he could look out onto Fremont Street. The window afforded him an excellent view of the gallows that stood in front of the jail, and as he stood at the window, he saw that an arriving stagecoach had to maneuver around the gallows because it took up so much of the damn street. Hooking his saddlebags over a rung in the chiffer robe, Smoke left his room and ambled down the stairs. It was time for him to find the Gold Strike Saloon and talk to Miss Minnie Smith. Between the hotel and the saloon, he passed the Homestead Hardware store, and he saw a little knot of people standing on the street just in front of the store, staring in through the window. Curious as to what could be drawing their attention, he made a point to walk close enough by the store to look in the window. There, lying on a table that was pitched up at about a 30-degree angle, just high enough to elevate the head, was the body of Andy Emerson. Both of Emerson's eyes were open, though on one the eyelid was half shut. He'd been shot in the back, so there was no visible wounds on the front of his body. His boots had been removed and his toes stuck through one of his socks. There was a hole in the bottom of the other sock. A hastily hand-lettered sign stood up alongside the body.
Andy Emerson shot by Sheriff Wallace in the line of duty.
The saloon was easy to find. The sign advertising it was a life-size cutout and painted figure of a smiling miner. The miner had a pickaxe slung over his right shoulder, while in his left hand was the reason for the smile. Holding the hand out in front of him, palm up, he was exhibiting a sparkling gold nugget. There was a somewhat smaller sign beside it of a mug of beer, gold at the bottom and white foam at the top. Smoke pushed his way through the bat wing doors, then stepped quickly to one side so that his back was to the wall as he looked the place over. The bar ran perpendicular to the door, from the front to the rear of the building along the right side of the room. There were several bottles of spirits sitting on glass shelves behind the bar, their numbers doubled by the mirror at their backs. Nearly a dozen customers stood at the bar, a few of them engaged in animated conversations, but most nursing their own drinks in privacy. Several of the tables had two or more customers, and at least one table had a card game in progress. A group of young women were standing next to the empty piano in the back. Seeing Smoke sit down alone, one of the girls who had been standing by the piano came over to talk to him.
Hi, cowboy. Something I can get you?
Smoke nodded toward a weeping young woman.
What's wrong with her?
That's Janet Farrell. Her boyfriend was just killed.
Would her boyfriend be Andy Emerson?
Yes. Did you know him?
I didn't know him, but I was an accidental witness to the shooting.
What do you mean you were an accidental witness to the shooting?
I had just arrived by a train, was seen to my horse being offloaded from the stock car when it happened. The man Emerson ran up onto the track just behind the train. That's where he was shot.
Oh, that's right. I heard that the train was still standing in the station when it happened. Tell me this, mister. Was Andy shooting back at the sheriff?
No. He didn't have a gun.
I knew it. Andy never carried a gun. But I know just as sure as God made little green apples that Sheriff Wallace is going to try and claim that he shot Andy in self-defense. Andy wouldn't walk away from a fight. Fact is, he sometimes started them. But not once in all the time I knew him did I ever see him with a gun.
I got the idea from the sheriff that he was always in trouble.
He was never in any real trouble. And anyone you ask will tell you that. It's just that Sheriff Wallace is a man who likes to boss people around. And Andy didn't take all that kindly to it. The sheriff hated him for that. Janet has taken this really hard. She blames herself for it.
Why does she blame herself?
Janet was always trying to get Andy to be less belligerent around the sheriff, but Andy wouldn't listen to her.
She has no reason to blame herself.
I know it. We all know it. And that's what we've been telling her. Now they've got poor Andy trussed up in the window of the hardware store like he's a side of beef or something. If you ask me, what that sheriff did by shooting him when he wasn't even carrying a gun wasn't much more than outright murder. And he is about to do the same thing again come Friday.
You're talking about the hanging?
Yes. Bobby Lee Cabot is innocent. And I could have proved it if the court had let me testify. But I know you didn't come in here to listen to me prattle on, so what can I do for you?
I'm new in town, and I need a friend.
Honey, as I am sure you can tell by the way I am dressed, that's what I do for a living. I am always friendly to handsome men. The truth is, they don't even have to be handsome. All they need is money. It just works out nice when they are handsome like you are.
Then tell me, my new friend, where can I find Minnie Smith?
What do you want with her?
I received a message from her.
Oh, my God. I didn't think you would come. You're Buck West, aren't you?
Yes. Am I correct in assuming that you're Minnie Smith?
Yes, I'm Minnie Smith.
We need to talk.
All right. Buy me a drink, Mr. West. That way I can sit and talk with you for a spell without anyone wondering what's going on.
I'd be glad to. And I'll have a beer.
Minnie started to the bar to get the drinks, but on her way, she stopped at one of the other tables and spoke to the two men who were there. Smoke saw her nod toward him then. And as she continued on toward the bar, the two men got up and, bringing their mugs with them, came over to Smoke's table.
And you would be Mr. West?
Smoke nodded, but he didn't speak.
May we join you?
Yes, please do.
The two men sat down as Minnie got a couple of beers at the bar.
I'm Doc Baker. This is Nate Neighbors. He owns this saloon.
Pleased to meet both of you.
I hope you don't mind, Mr. West. I told these two gentlemen that you were here.
Minnie returned with the two beers and sat down as well.
They know all about the telegram I sent you, and they know that you are one of Bobby Lee's friends. They want to help you if they can.
Help me with what?
Whatever it is you plan to do, Mr. West.
What makes you think I'm going to do anything?
I don't know. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought that being one of Bobby Lee's friends, you might... Well, that is, you did come in response to my telegram, didn't you? The telegram I sent you?
I did.
And you are a friend of Bobby Lee's.
I am.
Here's the thing, Mr. West. You are here, and we don't believe you would have come if you didn't plan to do something.
And if you do have something planned, we want to help because we don't believe Bobby Lee is guilty.
Are there many in town like you? Now by that, I mean people who don't believe Bobby Lee is guilty.
A few more, maybe, but I'm afraid there aren't too many of us who feel this way. And the problem is, Bobby Lee was brought in by passengers who were on the train when it was held up and the express man murdered. And that means he was obviously there.
Did anyone testify that he saw Bobby Lee shoot the messenger?
Nope. Nobody testified to that because nobody saw him do it. And the reason nobody saw him shoot the messenger is because he didn't do it.
But Bobby Lee was there.
Oh, yes, he was there.
Yeah. I was afraid of that. If he was there, then he bears some of the guilt.
Whose side are you on, Mr. West?
I'm just trying to find out as much as I can about what happened.
What happened is Frank Dodd and the others got away. Somebody has to hang, so it's going to be Bobby Lee.
No! He can't hang!
He sure as hell can. And if Mr. West here isn't able to do anything about it, Bobby Lee damn well will hang.
No! No!
Shh, Minnie. There's no need for everyone in town to know our business.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Did Bobby Lee present any defense? I mean, did he say why he was there?
Yeah. He said he was a railroad detective, and he'd worked his way into the gang to find out about him.
And he told the sheriff about the robbery. The sheriff and his deputies were supposed to be waiting in the car when the robbers arrived. That way the sheriff could catch them in the act.
Now what went wrong?
He trusted the sheriff. That's what went wrong.
The sheriff wasn't in the car.
Did he say why he wasn't in the car?
He claims that he never got the letter, and that there was no such plan between him and Bobby Lee.
But there was a letter.
How do you know?
Because he told me. In fact, he told all of us.
He told all three of you about the plan.
Yes, he told us before the robbery ever happened what he was planning to do.
Did you three testify to that in the trial?
We tried to, but they wouldn't let us testify. They said it was hearsay.
They wouldn't even swear us in as witnesses.
Huh. Are you a special friend to Bobby Lee?
What do you mean by special friend?
Smoke looked over toward the woman Minnie had identified as Janet Farrell. Janet was still crying about the death of Andy Emerson.
I mean, are you that kind of special friend?
I am as special a friend as a girl like me can be. What about you? How does he know you? He asked me to send the telegram to you, but he wasn't sure it would even get through. And he wasn't sure you would even come if it did. Evidently, he hadn't seen you in a while.
That's right. We haven't seen each other in a very long time. And the reason I know him is because I was once married to his sister.
Once married?
She's dead.
Oh. Mr. West, I'm sorry.
Yes. Actually, she was killed, along with my son.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Did the law ever catch the person who did it?
It wasn't a person. It was three persons. And the law didn't catch them. I did.
You caught him? You mean by yourself?
Yes.
How come I've never heard of you, Mr. West?
Well, maybe it's because my name isn't Buck West.
What? I don't understand. If you aren't Buck West, how did you get the telegram?
It's a name that I used once in my past. I believe Bobby Lee used it as a sort of a code when he sent the telegram. He knew that I would respond to that name, and I suppose he also knew that if he used it, I would realize that the telegram was authentic.
What is your real name?
Jensen. Kirby Jensen. But most people call me Smoke.
Nate Neighbors had just started to take a drink when he heard Smoke give his real name, and he jerked the mug back down so quickly that he spilled some of his beer.
You Smoke Jensen?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Jensen, let me tell you, it is an honor to meet you. And knowing that you're here, I feel better about the situation already.
Thank you. And it is Smoke, not Mr. Jensen.
Excuse my ignorance here, but is Smoke Jensen a name I should know?
You would know it if you ever read anything but those damn medical journals. Smoke Jensen is just about the most famous gunman. Make that best-known gunfighter, I mean. Well, I don't know what I mean. I know that he isn't a gunfighter who goes around looking for trouble, but he is the kind of man that folks turn to when they're in trouble.
Mr. Jensen, I'm not one who appreciates guns. I've had to pull out too many bullets from people who were too dumb to reason anything out and wound up letting their guns talk for them. But if you are here to help Bobby Lee, then I say, welcome to Cloverdale.
How?
How what?
How are you going to help him?
Well, now, to tell you the truth, Minnie, I haven't quite got that figured out yet.
When you figure it out, if there is anything I can do to help, please let me know.
I will, and thanks.
No. Thank you for responding to the telegram.
There's no way I wasn't going to respond. Like I told you, Bobby Lee is family.
Approximately 60 miles north of Cloverdale, in the small town of Desolation, Emmett Clark was sitting in on a poker game at the New Promise Saloon.
Deal 'em.
One of the other players was Jules Stillwater. and at this precise moment he was extremely agitated. The cause of Stillwater's agitation was the attention Cindy was paying to Emmett Clark. She was watching the game from her position behind Clark, and her hand was resting lightly on Clark's shoulder.
Cindy, my neck is stiff. Why don't you come over here and rub it?
You willing to pay for it?
Why should I pay for it? Clark paying you to put your hand on his shoulder?
No.
Then come over here and rub my neck like I asked. That's what you're supposed to do, ain't it? Keep the customers happy.
You aren't a customer unless you pay for it. If I'm not getting paid, then I'll be with who I want to be.
Stillwater, I reckon she told you all right.
McWorthy had served 10 years in prison for shooting a man back in Wichita. Nobody knew if he was actually wanted now or not, but he had arrived in Desolation a few months earlier, purposely choosing the town because of its reputation as being friendly to outlaws. McWorthy supported himself by petty larceny, which he carried on in surrounding towns, always retreating back to Desolation. It was McWorthy's deal, and his hands moved swiftly as he folded the cards in and out until he was satisfied with the shuffle. He pushed the cards towards Stillwater, who cut them, then pushed them back.
Is 5-card draw all right with everyone?
Yeah, 5-card draw is fine. Cindy, let me tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna win Clark's poke. Then after I take all his money, I'm gonna spend every cent of it on you. What you think about that?
If you've got the money, I'll be your honey.
Clark lost $15 on the first hand after having folded cautiously with a hand that would have been good enough to win had he stayed in the game. Stillwater won the hand, and he dragged in the pot.
If you ain't got the guts to play the game, you might want to sit out the next hand. You should have bet them cards.
Clark gave up the next hand as well, even though it was strong enough to have at least bet the first round.
Damn! I don't need to come up with no more jobs. Not as long as I can win money from you.
Clark was down $30 by the third hand, but there was over $60 in the pot, and he had drawn 2 cards to complete a full house. When the bet came to him, he put his hand on the money, pushed it out, then drew it back. Then he thought about it for a moment, and then pushed it back out.
What? You mean you gonna bet this time? Whoa, you better be careful now. I won't think about that. You won't get too brave. Well, I see you're 5. I'll raise you 5.
Clark studied his hand for a long moment.
I'll call.
All right, Clark, let's see your cards.
Stillwater was holding 3 jacks.
You're holding a full house and you didn't raise?
You might have had a stronger hand. Like to be certain about things. And as you can see, prudence was a good choice. I'm now $40 ahead.
You don't know much about cards, do you? Hell, if not had that hand, I'd have won $80, maybe $100 with it.
But you didn't have that hand, did you?
Tell you what, kid. Why don't I just show you what this game's all about? I've been laying off you a bit because I can see you don't have no idea about playing cards. Well, I'm about to teach you how to play. It's going to cost you some money.
You mean you want me to pay you for lessons?
No, you don't have to pay me. I'll just take the money from you and that'll be less than enough for you. All you got to do is pay attention while you're losing. I'm going to take every dollar you have and spend it all on Cindy.
Oh, well then, Cindy can't lose, can't you?
What are you, some kind of wise guy?
Though Clark gave no outward sign, inwardly he smiled. Stillwater was extremely agitated now, and the more agitated he became, the more injudicious would be his decisions. This was going to be an interesting game.
I'm going to ante the limit this time.
Clark put his hand on the money and held it for a moment as if thinking about it. Then he pushed the money forward.
$10.
Oh! Well, $10, that's a little steep for you, ain't it?
Not too bad. I'm $40 ahead, so I'm not actually betting with my own money.
You're not betting with your own money. No, that's just real smart now. I tell you what, how about we up the ante a little?
Up the ante?
Sure, why not? Like you say, you ain't playing with your own money. Will it hurt if you lose a little?
I don't know. If we raised the ante, it wouldn't take too long before I'd be playing with my own money again.
So what you're saying is, you're afraid to raise the ante.
I wouldn't say I'm afraid.
You wouldn't, huh? You know, what would you say?
I think I'd rather say that I'm cautious.
Did you hear that, boys? I say he's afraid, but he says he's cautious. What do you say, Cindy? Is he cautious or is he afraid?
Jules, why don't you quit picking on him?
No, I ain't gonna quit picking on him. Sat down to play a man's game with men, so let him be a man. Now what you say, boy? You gonna raise the ante, or are you too scared?
I suppose I'll go along with raising the ante.
Yeah.
Stillwater shoved the cards across the table to Clark.
It's your deal. You know how to deal, don't you?
Yes, I know how to deal. Everyone knows how to deal.
Clark picked up the cards, and then skillfully, and without being detected, felt them as he began shuffling, checking for pinpricks and uneven corners. He was satisfied that they were playing with an honest deck. In truth, Clark was exceptionally skilled at cards, but had purposely passed himself off as a novice. Evidently, his ruse had worked, because Stillwater was sure of himself to the point of overconfidence. And that, Stillwater's overconfidence, was the only edge Clark needed in the game. Clark dealt the cards. The other players, perhaps motivated by the supposed recklessness of Clark and Stillwater, bet briskly, so that within a few moments, the pot was over $200.
Wait a minute. What am I doing here? I'm $40 into this pot. How'd it get so big? I can't afford to stay in this game.
Well, you have this fella to thank for that. He's all full of himself because he won the last hand.
I haven't been raising the bets, I've just been matching them. And I think Conklin is right. It's gotten too high, but I'm almost too afraid to drop out now. Wish I'd been more prudent. I fear that I have too much invested.
Now, Sonny, you are in a man's game. Now, let's just see how much of a man you are. It's going to cost you $100 to stay in.
That's it. I'm out also. Stillwater, you ain't got no right to just up and buy a pot like that.
Same rules goes for you as goes for the kid here. If you ain't man enough to stay in the game, you shouldn't have got into it in the first place. Huh. Guess that means I won.
Stillwater reached for the pot and started to pull it toward him.
And now, kid, this is what I mean by teaching you a lesson.
Wait a minute. Don't I get a chance to bet?
You want to bet? Yeah, sure, go ahead. Well, me and Cindy can have us a fine old time on your money. The bet to you is $100.
The hesitancy and confusion left Clark's face, and he stared across the table at Stillwater and smiled.
I'll see your 100 and 200 more to you.
What?
Clark laid his hand down, putting four cards to one side and one card separated from the others.
If you want to see my hand, it's going to cost you $200.
I ain't got that much money. Conklin, lend me $200.
Now tell me, Jules, if I ain't going to put up the money to stay in the game myself, why should I back you?
McWhorter!
I ain't got $200, Stillwater. I ain't even got $100. And I wouldn't lend it to you if I did have it. Look at the way he laid them cards down. Hell, he's got four of a kind, and I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't four aces. I mean, you've seen how slow he's been to bet. You know damn well he wouldn't be betting no $200 if he didn't have himself a winning hand.
He's bluffing, Stillwater.
Hell,
I can tell by looking at him that he's bluffing. Call his hand.
Really? Don't forget, this is a fella who wouldn't even raise a full house. Is that what you got, Clark? Full house?
It can't be a full house. Look at the way he has them cards lying there. Four to one side and one to the other.
It's like I said, he's got four of a kind.
Well, somebody lend me $200. Anybody!
I will.
Nah. I know if the winning came right down to it, you'd come back over to my side.
If you win, I'll take the money right now. But if you lose, then I'm gonna want to be repaid $400.
What makes you think I have $400?
Maybe you don't have it right now, but you'll be doing another job with Frank Dodd soon, and when you do, I'll expect my $400.
All right. It's a deal.
Jules, you might want to think about this for a bit.
What do you mean?
Look at where she's been standing. You think she don't know what his hand is? Now, you gotta ask yourself, is she doing this just so she can get a cut of your money next time we do a job? She might just be trying to sucker you in.
Yeah? Yeah, you think you got me in your sights, don't you?
I'm just trying to learn the game.
All right. All right, pot's yours.
Stillwater turned his cards up on the table. He had a full house, aces over jacks.
What you got?
Clark's cards stayed face down on the table, just the way he'd left them. Four in one pile, one in the other. He reached out to rake in his pot.
I asked you a question, mister. What you got?
He reached for Clark's cards, but Clark caught him around the wrist with a vice grip.
I don't know all that much about this game, but I know that if you don't pay, you don't see. You didn't pay, so you don't see him.
With his other hand, Stillwater slid a $20 bill across the table.
Is that enough to let me see?
I reckon so. Like I said, if you're willing to pay for it.
Clark turned up his cards. Instead of four of a kind, there were two small pairs.
What? I had a full house. You didn't have me beat.
Well, now let's think about that, Stillwater. You are right. My cards didn't beat your cards, but I did beat you. It's called running a bluff. What you think, Cindy? Looks like he won't be spending any of my money on you after all. That's all right. I'll spend some of his money on you.
Mister, I ain't gonna forget this.
Stillwater stood up, then walked quickly and angrily out of the saloon.
Kid, he's my partner riding with him. But I gotta tell you, he ain't the kind you want on your bad side. If I was you, I'd be mighty careful around him from now on.
Thanks, I'll heed your advice.
Cloverdale is a nice town. That's why I moved my practice here. Right now, we are at the end of track. But if they ever continue it on into California, as I believe they will, it will be an even nicer town.
It'd be nicer now if it weren't for Wallace.
Tell me about the sheriff.
I saw a word one time that fits the sheriff. The word was potentate. That's what this sheriff thinks he is.
But he was elected, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Now, he was elected, all right. And if you ask the average person on the street what kind of job they think he is doing, they would probably say he is doing a good job. He keeps his jail full of drunks, people who spit on the street, deadbeats, and the like, but all the time he is doing that, people like Frank Dodd and his gang operate with impunity.
Impunity? And now you see here, Smoke, that's why I like to keep the doc on as my friend. How many people you know who can use a word like impunity?
Smoke thought of his wife, Sally, back at the Sugar Loaf. A former school teacher and the smartest person he had ever known. Impunity would be one of her words. He smiled.
It's a good word, all right.
Just then, Sheriff Wallace came barging into the saloon. He stomped over to the table where the four of them were sitting.
Minnie, have you heard anything back from that telegram you sent to Buck West?
What? How'd you know I sent a telegram?
I'm the sheriff. It's my business to know.
Minnie looked over towards Smoke, who, with a barely perceptible shake of his head, cautioned her to say nothing about it.
Well, if it's your business to know, then you probably already know that I didn't hear anything back from him.
It's just as well. I don't know what Cabot had in mind when he had you send that telegram, but I plan to keep a close eye on him.
Sheriff, I don't know what happened to that letter he sent you, but if you had gotten it, you would know that he really didn't have anything to do with that holdup.
There was no letter.
There was, too. I don't know why you never received it, but there was a letter. Even if it had been no letter, he talked to you about it. He made plans for you to be waiting for him in the express car.
And you know this because...
I know this because he told me about it before the robbery took place. He told all three of us. And we were ready to testify about it, too, but the judge wouldn't allow it.
The judge said that we could not testify because it would not be direct information. It would be considered hearsay.
Only you could have testified that he set up an arrangement with you.
But you didn't do it.
I didn't do it because there was no letter, and he didn't talk to me. Don't you understand what he was doing? He was setting up his alibi with you. I'll give him this. For all that he is a train robber and murderer, he's smart. It takes someone smart to set up something like that. But what it all comes down to is his word against mine. The jury believed me, They didn't believe Cabot.
I believe him.
Why should you believe him? You're in the courtroom, Doc. You heard the letter they read from the WCSA. They said no such investigation had been authorized. No, sir. Bobby Lee Cabot is guilty as sin.
And because the judge wouldn't agree to let us testify, he's going to hang.
Yes, ma'am. He is going to hang, all right. We are going to have us one Jim Dandy of a hanging. We'll have folks coming in from all over the county this Friday morning to watch it. And I don't plan to let them be disappointed by anything this Buck West fella might have in mind. I reckon this is going to be about one of the best days for business we've ever had. If it goes over as well as I think it will, why, I just might see if I can't arrange a hanging about every month or so. It'll bring so much business into town that I'll have every storekeeper in town voting for me.
You murderer!
Janet was coming from the kitchen, moving quickly toward the sheriff with a butcher knife in her hand.
You killed Andy!
What the hell?
Wallace started to draw his gun, but before he could, Smoke reached out and grabbed Janet's wrist, forcing her to drop the knife. Looking back toward Wallace, Smoke saw that he was still holding his gun, though he wasn't pointing it at anyone.
Put your gun away, Sheriff.
You see that crazy bitch? She tried to kill me.
You were never in any real danger. Now put your gun away unless you plan to kill an unarmed woman in front of all these witnesses.
Wallace hesitated for a moment, then returned his pistol to his holster. He pointed at Neighbors.
She works for you, and I'm telling you right now that you had better keep her under control.
You're gonna try anything like that again, are you, Janet?
Janet shook her head no.
You won't have any more trouble with her, Sheriff.
Yeah, well, like I say, you just damn well better keep her under control.
There was a long moment of silence after the sheriff left. Then a couple of the other saloon girls went over to comfort Janet, and general conversation in the saloon resumed.
It looks bad for Bobby Lee, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
So, what you're saying is there is no way we can stop the hanging this Friday?
No, I didn't say that. He's not going to hang this Friday.
But you said that it looks bad for him.
I can stop the hanging.
How?
If he's not in jail, they can't hang him. And I intend to get him out of jail. But this isn't enough. We're also going to have to prove his innocence. If we don't do that, he'll just be an escaped prisoner with wanted posters plastered in just every state and territory west of the Mississippi.
Do you think you can prove he's innocent?
Let me ask you this. Do you believe he's innocent?
Yes, of course I do. Don't you believe he is innocent?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I last saw Bobby Lee. But it doesn't matter to me whether he's innocent or not. I don't intend to let him hang.
If he is innocent, and I believe with all my heart that he is, will you be able to prove it?
Yes. If he is innocent, I will prove it.
How?
We'll start by finding the man who actually did kill the express messenger.
That would be Frank Dodd.
Yes.
Well, that's quite an order. There's a rather significant reward out for him, and people have been after him for at least 3 years now.
We'll find him.
You said you were going to get Bobby Lee out of jail?
That's right.
And how are you going to do that?
If you know beforehand how I'm going to do it, then you'd be a co-conspirator. It's better that you don't know. All I can say is, when it happens, you'll know.
Back in Desolation, everyone was still talking and laughing about the bluff Emmett Clark had run on Jules Stillwater. There was some concern as to how Stillwater would handle it, but most thought he would do nothing more than sulk around for a few days. But Stillwater had something else in mind. And the first indication Emmett Clark had of Stillwater's sudden intrusion into the saloon was when a bullet from Stillwater's gun smashed the glass that was sitting on the table between Clark and Cindy. Even before the second bullet plowed into the table, Clark leaped up from his chair. But to his shocked surprise, the back of the chair caught the handle of his pistol and jerked it out of his holster.
You son of a bitch! Cindy's my woman! You stay the hell away from her!
Jules, have you gone crazy? I'm anyone's woman who will buy me a drink, you know that!
Stillwater fired again as Clark dashed across the saloon toward the bar. Stillwater's third shot was fired as Clark rolled across the bar and onto the floor behind. Clark spied the double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun the bartender kept behind the bar.
You think you could hide behind the bar?
Looking toward the sound of the voice, Clark saw that Stillwater had come to the open end of the bar, and he was now looking down at Clark, an evil smile displaying his pleasure of now having the advantage.
Took the wrong man's woman, you snot-nosed kid!
Stillwater was holding a smoking pistol, which Clark knew held three more shots. Stillwater smiled triumphantly. Then he saw the shotgun in Clark's hands, and that smile of triumph changed quickly to an expression of horror. Clark put the gun down, then lay still on his back for a long moment, relieved that he was still alive. Gun smoke was swirling about, now permeating the room with its nostril-burning acrid smell. Finally, Clark stood up. Walking back over to the table, he picked up his pistol, which was still lying on the floor.
Cindy, are you all right?
I'm fine.
What was this all about? Why'd he come after me like that?
I don't know why. I mean, he always hung around me anytime him and his friends were here, but there was never no word spoke or nothing to make him think we was anything but just friends. I mean, he knowed what I'd done for a living.
Who the hell just killed Stillwater?
Clark saw Frank Dodd coming in. Almost imperceptibly, Clark moved his hand closer to his pistol, not knowing how Dodd was going to react to losing one of his men.
I killed him.
Stillwater's the one that started it. He come in here blazing away.
Dodd walked over to look out at the body. Stillwater's eyes were open and opaque. His mouth was set in a sneer.
You carry a shotgun, do you?
Not normally. I just happened to have one handy when I needed it.
You just had one handy, did you?
Stillwater needed killing, Frank. Hell, the way that dumb sumbitch was blasting away, he could have killed any of us.
Dodd stroked his chin and nodded to Conklin as he stood there looking down at Stillwater's body.
The only thing is, that makes four good men I've lost in the last week.
You lost four men, but you didn't lose four good men, not if Stillwater was any indication.
I suppose you think you are better than they were.
Hell yeah, I'm better. I'm better than all four of them combined.
What do you think, Conklin? Sounds to me like this boy's applying for a job.
Sounds like that to me, too.
What about it, boy? You want to ride with me?
Yeah, I do. If truth be told, that's why I came here in the first place.
What do you say, Conklin? Is he as good as Stillwater was?
Look at it this way, Frank. Stillwater and this boy had a face-to-face showdown, and the boy won.
All right, boy. You can ride with us.
Not so fast.
What do you mean, not so fast? I thought you wanted to ride with me.
I do, but not if you're going to keep calling me boy.
So, you don't want to be called boy, do you?
My name is Clark. Emmett Clark.
Well, all right, Mr. Emmett Clark. I reckon anyone who can come out on top of a fight with Stillwater has earned the right to be called by his name.
In that case, Mr. Dodd, I'd be just real happy to ride with you.